Good morning. Chris Terrell on behalf of the petitioner appellant Julian Lopez. This matter is before the court from a denial of a petition for writ of habeas corpus that was filed in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, emanating from Milwaukee County throughout the appellate process in the state of Wisconsin. Subsequent thereto to the denial of the petition, Judge Clavert granted an order for certificate of appealability. And the order was granted on one issue. The one issue that was requested was whether a trial counsel rendered ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to request an instruction for the lesser-included offense of felony murder on the primary charge of first-degree intentional homicide as a party to a crime, thereby denying petitioner his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Now, this is the second time I've been in front of this court with what I call it the much-dreaded anti-terrorism and effective death penalty act of 1996, because in order for this court to grant the request that we're making in this particular case, the AEDPA obviously applies. And it somewhat puts a chilling effect on these cases as far as this court granting these types of actions. But the reality is there's a heavy burden that needs to bear here. And we all know what that heavy burden is. And I'm going to restate it for the court because I think it's important to do so. Number one, the statute dictates that a federal court, this court, may not grant habeas relief on any claim adjudicated on its merits in state court unless the state court's decision was either contrary to or involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, as of course determined by the United States Supreme Court, or resulted in a decision that was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented in the state court proceeding. And once again, this is a heavy burden. The summary of the argument put forth in the briefs, and the summary that I'm going to tell you here today, is that Lopez claims, first of all, that the state court decision involved both an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And when I say that, I mean the application of Strickland, the now famous Strickland two-prong test, as applied to the facts of this particular case. And also resulted in a decision based upon an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented. And that issue relates specifically to a determination as to whether or not the lesser included offense was discussed between defendant and defense counsel as applied before the state appellate court and at the trial court level. Now, with regard to the two-prong Strickland test, we all know the two prongs. One is deficient performance, and the second is prejudice. We have to show, number one, the counsel's performance was so deficient that it fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. And then, of course, we move on to the but-for prong with regard to prejudice. That but-for the deficient performance, there is a reasonable probability that the outcome in this particular case would have been different. Focusing specifically on the deficient performance aspect of this particular case, focusing on the failure to request an instruction on the lesser-included offense of felony murder, the case law in this particular court is as follows. In a non-capital case, the failure to instruct on a lesser-included offense, even if incorrect under state law, does not warrant setting aside the conviction unless that failure to instruct amounts to a fundamental miscarriage of justice. Now, as I pointed out in the briefs and as the case law shows, we have to demonstrate that had the omitted instructions been given, a reasonable jury would have found Mr. Lopez guilty of felony murder rather than first-degree intentional homicide. In essence, we're looking for unequivocally strong evidence, whether or not there was a reasonable grounds for acquittal on the greater charge, first-degree intentional homicide, and also conviction on the lesser charge.
Suppose there had been sufficient evidence to support a theory that Julian and Arthur Lopez set off intending only to rob Jelani to collect a drug debt, and that the plan went awry and Arthur shot Jelani when his identity was revealed. There was no evidence presented that someone accidentally fired a gun in the course of the robbery, was there? I mean, because Jelani was shot 5 times in his head and neck at close range. Regardless of what anyone intended at the start of that crime, someone, it would seem, intended to kill Jelani at the moment the gun was fired.
Well, the way I looked at the facts, and the only, I think one of the ways that the petitioner can prevail is if you look at all of the evidence, and the trial court, the Court of Appeals, the Wisconsin Supreme Court never took the case, and the district court all found that there was no evidence to support felony murder conviction, or even to give the instruction for that matter. But you hit the nail on the head. If I can't convince this court, factually speaking, that there were enough facts put forth at the trial, we lose. Simple as that. If you find there are sufficient facts, perhaps we prevail, because I think at that point the trial court, even if the defendant didn't ask for it, the trial court should have given the instruction. Getting back to what your point was, if there was the intent to steal, one of the elements of armed robbery, and during the commission of this particular felony, Arthur Lopez, as Luis Acevedo testified to, actually took a gun and shot the victim in this particular case, your question is, does that amount to a felony murder instruction? And I believe it does. Simply because there was a murder committed. It wasn't the murder itself wasn't intended, initially speaking. It came about or arose as a result of this, what I would consider an attempted armed robbery. Simply because I don't know if there was enough evidence to suggest that any money was taken from the victim, whether or not any drugs were taken from any victim. But I believe that there was evidence on this record to suggest that they were there, as Acevedo testified to collect on a drug debt. I hope that answers your question.
There to collect on a drug debt?
Correct.
Yeah, and this is what confuses me, is why they disguised themselves. Because didn't they have on ski masks and things?
That's correct. There was testimony from last
debt. You have to assert that the guy owes you money.
And or you're collecting the debt for somebody else.
Well, you're not collecting a debt. Now, if you're talking about just plain old robbery, they don't even maybe not know him, or maybe they know the guy's got money or something. Maybe then they don't want him to know who they are. And that, I'm trying to get some logic of why they would disguise themselves if they're trying to collect debt from somebody. To first of all, you got to tell them, hey, you owe me money. I don't know.
Well,
I'm not
very
good at this. But
I was sitting in the back of the courtroom and I was reviewing my notes, and I thought to myself, I never thought about that question, and here it is being asked to me. And the simple response I can give to that is, if they are there to perhaps collect a drug debt for perhaps somebody above them, it still can be considered an armed robbery, an attempt to collect a debt for somebody else.
I mean, where they wouldn't want to identify themselves, I guess.
Obviously they wouldn't want the victim in this particular case, Mr. Jelani, to know that they were acting on behalf of some other drug dealer or perhaps somebody else.
Well, when they said Junior, that apparently set somebody off, saying, well, now he knows who I am, now I got to kill him, I guess. I don't know.
Right, well, at that point, I guess the gig was up, because, and that gets back to the question that was posed, insofar as that testimony seems unequivocally clear that this particular homicide does not take place until Arthur Lopez, or my client, allegedly blurts out the name of Junior, at which point Arthur Lopez's name becomes known to the alleged victim, at which point, during the course of what we would consider this attempt at armed robbery, a homicide occurs. So it's at that point that I believe perhaps there is enough evidence to give the instruction on felony murder, at least to give the jury something else to consider versus first-degree intentional homicide.
Of course, the trial judge said he wouldn't have given the instruction.
Correct. And
given the evidence that he heard.
Correct. And the trial judge also, this is a secondary argument that was made in the brief, but I was somewhat struck by the fact that the trial judge that answered the post-conviction motions was the same trial judge that handed the trial. And there was no Mockner hearing that took place in this particular case. And we all know what a Mockner hearing is. It's a hearing after the fact where defendant comes in to testify, defense counsel can testify about anything that took place. I was somewhat shocked at the fact that there was no Mockner hearing granted so that the court could decipher out, number one, whether or not there were any discussions between defendant and counsel, specifically as to whether or not they should have asked for a lesser included, and number two, whether or not Mr. Lopez even understood the colloquy that took place between Judge Wagner and himself when they were talking about whether or not he went over the lesser included with his attorney. And I addressed that issue in the briefs also.
And the Court of Appeals found that it was discussed.
Excuse me?
The Wisconsin Court of Appeals found that it was discussed.
That's correct, they did.
So that's a finding we're supposed to respect, right?
Well, I guess you could respect it, but
no,
I made
no,
the
argument. I think we're stuck with it. That's a finding. That's the problem with habeas. And yeah, when you're talking about this review, it's not. That's something we don't, just, unless it's so obviously wrong.
Well, and that was the argument that I made. I mean, there's a second prong to this, and the second prong was whether or not it was in a reasonable application of the facts as determined previously. And that was, and I understand that it's a difficult hurdle for Mr. Lopez to leap. And the law, and I, if I could just finish my point.
Of course.
These are very difficult cases, and they're very difficult cases for lawyers because we know when we get these cases. I mean, I have family members in the courtroom here. They come into my office, and they expect me to make an argument on my client's behalf, and I have to explain to them the large hurdle. And based upon what I saw here, initially speaking, I review the materials, and I make a determination. If you're going to spend the money, don't spend it if it's not going to be spent wisely, if there's no claim to be made. I felt, looking at this evidence, that there was a chance this forum might find that enough evidence came forth at the trial to suggest the lesser included a felony murder.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Cirillo. Mr. Ganser.
May it please the Court. My name is William Gansner, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, representing the appellee in this case. Mr. Trella,
could I just point you one way, something that's in my thoughts. The State Court of Appeals obviously considered Strickland in making its ineffective assistance determination. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, in its recitation of the evidence, it ignored all of the evidence that was presented by Acevedo that this may have been a robbery to collect a drug debt. In evaluating effective assistance under Strickland and thus determining whether the evidence would have supported a lesser included instruction, was it unreasonable for the district court to apply the facts in a way that ignored any evidence of a robbery?
Well, I think it might be unreasonable and would certainly be reasonable to argue that it was unreasonable if that had happened. But, Your Honor, I disagree with your characterization of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision. At page 3 of the Court of Appeals decision, early on in their recitation of facts, they summarized the opinion or the testimony of various witnesses at trial, including particularly Luis Acevedo. And they do note very clearly that according to Acevedo, Julian Lopez said that he and Arthur Lopez approached Jelani's car to collect money that Jelani owed on a drug debt. I think that the court was aware and did reference the fact that there was testimony of a drug debt and suggestive of the motivation for the confrontation between Jelani and the two Lopez's was to collect the drug debt. So I think in all fairness to the Court of Appeals decision, they did note that. I don't believe they brushed over it or ignored it. So I don't think it was... I think the premise of your question, fair question, but I think the premise may be misfounded. I do believe they considered that evidence. What was crucial here, and habeas cases often bring before this court, arising as they do out of state criminal convictions, the peculiarities or the distinctive features of a state's substantive law, but the substantive law of Wisconsin, which is important to understand in this case, is that felony murder in Section 940.03 of the Wisconsin statutes is significantly distinguished from first-degree intentional homicide in 940.01, not simply because of the significant difference in the penalty, but first-degree intentional homicide is an intentional killing of another person. felony murder under 940.03 is, in essence, an unintentional killing during the commission of another crime specified in the statute, several, sexual assault, armed robbery, etc. What was critical in this case was that the Court of Appeals concluded that whoever did the shooting in this case, Julian Lopez or Arthur Lopez, the killing was intentional. As you noted, Judge Rovner, there were multiple gunshots fired into the head and neck of Mr. Jelani at contact close range, immediately next to him. Multiple gunshots. In addition to there having been evidence of blunt trauma to his head, presumably from his having been pistol whipped. But the shooting followed that. Whether the shooter, as the Court of Appeals concluded, was Mr. Lopez, Julian Lopez, or Arthur Lopez, the Court of Appeals concluded, and I think this is frankly indisputable, that the killing was an intentional act. You cannot discharge multiple bullets into the head of a person from immediately adjacent to their head without intending the natural and probable consequences of that conduct. That is what distinguished this case from felony murder. And that is why the State Court of Appeals concluded, as a matter of state law, that an instruction on felony murder was not warranted, because this was clearly, whoever the shooter was, it was an intentional killing. Wisconsin law is very clear that it takes, and we're certainly consistent with the substantive law of other states in this respect, it takes no appreciable period of time in advance of an act for intent to kill to be formed. If one shoots multiple times into a person's head on the spur of the moment, immediately after whatever preceded it, one, the law does in fact presume that you intended to kill. So what we had here was, the Court of Appeals concluded under Wisconsin law, an intentional killing that took this out of the realm of felony murder. Because felony murder consists of an individual is committing some other crime, and either through negligence or recklessness or conduct without regard to the safety of the other person, without a specific intent to kill, kills the victim while committing another crime. And thus, state law provides for a different and lesser penalty. If an intentional killing during the commission of some other crime was felony murder, the law would have been turned upside down. What we had here was an intentional killing that may very well have occurred during an attempt to collect, to rob someone, to collect on a drug debt. Though that does not reduce the intentional killing to an unintended felony murder.
This is the second murder, wasn't it?
Excuse me?
Were there two murders? Isn't there an earlier conviction?
There is reference in the record to
consecutive.
Yes, Mr. Lopez was convicted in an unrelated case earlier of another homicide. That is right. That is unrelated to this case. So, in essence, what we have here is what I believe is what we are quite often confronted with in ineffective assistance of counsel cases. If we were here simply on a claim by the defendant that I should have received a lesser-included offense instruction, I suspect that a certificate of appealability would not have been granted, because that claim by itself, I was entitled to a lesser-included offense instruction under Wisconsin law, is not a federally cognizable claim, cognizable in a habeas corpus action. In the absence of any controlling United States authority in non-capital cases establishing a right to lesser-included offense instructions, and we are in the absence of any such holding, that is a claim that would not be cognizable at all. And, moreover, the determination by the state court that as a matter of state law, a lesser-included offense instruction was not warranted is an interpretation and application of state law that is binding, I believe, on this court. But we are here because this underlying claim that I should have received an lesser-included offense instruction has been elevated, brought up, wrapped inside a claim of ineffectiveness of counsel. It is claimed that while I had no constitutional right to a lesser-included offense instruction, I do have a right to effective representation, and my counsel was ineffective in failing to ask for an instruction that state law doesn't require and this Constitution doesn't require. The fact that this state law claim of entitlement to a lesser-included offense instruction comes before this court in an ineffective assistance of counsel claim does not alter the fundamental point that at the basis of this case is a question of state law binding upon this court by its interpretation of the state court of appeals that went against the defendant. He was not denied his right to effective assistance of counsel when his attorney did not request a lesser-included offense instruction that could not be given under state law.
Thank you, Mr. Ganser.
Thank you.
Mr. Cirillo, your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute.
I'll comment on two issues. Number one, counsel indicated that felony murder is an unintentional killing, and I disagree, and I'm going to give you a hypothetical. If three guys go into a bank and one guy is watching the door and two guys are grabbing the money and somebody tries to leave and the guy at the door says, look, if you leave, I'm going to shoot you, and he shoots that person dead, he's made a premeditated killing. At that point, he can be tried and convicted of first-degree intentional homicide. The other two people grabbing the money, that homicide took place in the furtherance of a bank robbery. They can't be tried and convicted for first-degree intentional homicide in Wisconsin. They can be tried and convicted for felony murder because there was no intent on their part to do any killing whatsoever. At that point, if they were to go to trial, the charge would be felony murder. It would not be first-degree intentional homicide. Secondly, there was a statement by counsel as to there was no right to a lesser-included offense at the state court level. That, whether or not that's true isn't the point. The point of the matter is this. It is fundamentally ineffective at certain times not to ask for a lesser included. I do a lot of trial work in the state courts in around Milwaukee County. And once again, hypothetically speaking, if you have a case that is charged out as possession with intent to deliver, and three people testify for the defense that the client, the defendant, had a drug problem, and even though there was a large amount, that was going to be used for personal use, I'm sorry, but if you don't request a lesser included, given that evidence, you've made a mistake. Because if the evidence is there and you don't ask for it, and Lord knows there are judges perhaps that wouldn't even give it if you don't ask for it, which, you know, such is the case, but if you don't ask for it, you are fundamentally deficient if the evidence is there. And that's what we're claiming here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cirillo. And again, thanks to Mr. Ganser. The case is taken under advisement.